So, welcome back. We are in our second week of a new speaking series called Shalom. Pardon my accent. So, Shalom, in a word, is peace. It is actually the Hebrew word for peace. But last week, Carrie presented us a message identifying Shalom as it's quite a bit deeper than our concept of peace. Shalom is more than a lack of internal or external conflict. In the Hebrew culture, it actually represents completion, a settling of things such that whatever is in conflict, be it different people or an internal struggle, whatever's in conflict is made whole again. So it's more than simply peace or a truce. It's a reparation, a reconciliation. So in describing this concept, Carrie highlighted achieving wholeness requires surrender. Surrender by trusting God to provide that which only he can provide, peace. But not just peace, reconciliation. And reconciliation being God's entire purpose. So this surrender that leads to reconciliation requires one key component, humility. You can see in the graphic, we have humility as the second week. So, as is customary, before we get into speaking about it, we need to lay down some definitions. So, what is humility? I was told we have a slide. Cool. So, the textbook definition of humility is having or showing a modest or low estimate of one's own importance, having low social, administrative, or political rank, lower in dignity or importance. Someone who is lower in dignity or importance. So textbook definitions are all well and good, but usually they don't meet the same connotations as what we understand of the word. So would anyone care to share a definition what they think is humility? You don't have to. Okay. Thinking more of yourself than others. Okay.
Wait a minute.
So, I think we all can agree you're correct. Humility is a state of actively choosing not to pursue an advantage over others. Not in your hobbies, not in your dreams, not in your achievements, not at your job, not with your family. Seeking yourself not only second, but absolutely last. So, which what Rachel was getting at, when we put ourselves in a position of power or importance over others, we've missed the mark. And just so you know, the word for sin in Hebrew is a word pronounced chata. And it does not mean to do evil or to do wrong. It means to miss. The point being, they did not understand sin as do's and don'ts. They understood sin as failing to meet an archetype, failing to meet an expectation. If you did something evil, that was not humble, and you've missed the mark. So when we put ourselves above the others, we miss the mark. Because if you really think about this and just kind of switch your frame of reference, if you're not self-centered, you would be looking outward. And if you're looking outward, you would realize each person has something to offer us. Each person has a role to play or an experience to provide us. Each person has something that they can teach us. So humility, in a sense, and I think the best way to describe it or actually catch the true meaning of the word, humility, in a sense, is not writing other people off. As in, when you approach them, you don't look at them, make a snap judgment, and just immediately make assumptions about them and assume that they can't teach you anything and they have nothing to offer you. So just simply not writing people off. Living with the understanding that everyone you come into contact with has something to teach. And it will crop up in the most unexpected places. So some people have something to teach you verbally. Some people can teach you through experience, an experience they have had or an experience that you have because of them. Others will help you learn from their mistakes or foolishness. So I'm glad my big brother's not here because I'm going to tell a story on him. So when my big brother and I were in high school, we were just starting to drive. He, obviously being my big brother, started to drive before me. And his first car was a 1972 Chevrolet pickup truck. If you haven't seen one of these things, they're very pretty, and they are solid steel, toe-to-toe. Gets about half a mile to the gallon. When you hear one start up, you'll probably hear it start up three times because it takes that, you know, many times to get gas into the engine. So he was very proud of this truck. And I'll never forget the first night he was trusted to drive that truck without an adult in the vehicle, which we lived like right next to our church, not a half mile from our church. And so dad's like, you can, my dad doesn't actually sound like this, but like, you can go ahead and drive the truck to church. And it's like, okay, cool. And so I went with him. And so we drove to church, no incident, and we drove away from church. But in between the church and our driveway was an old, really beat up dirt road. Probably wasn't actually on the county's radar until like maybe 10 years ago. And this dirt road went down into a valley and then up a steep hill. And on top of that steep hill, because there's not really any road maintenance, there is a 5-foot ditch on either side of the road on this hill. And so this road would go up the hill, and then there's a crossroad, again, not documented, with these deep ditches on either side of it. And because there's no road maintenance, there is no electric lights, no street lamps, nothing. So we're on our way home from church, and this is just a half mile that my father has trusted my brother with this truck. Just half a mile. That is it. Well, on the way home, he's like, let's tear this thing up there. And I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. I don't know how to drive yet. I don't care. And so we turn off on this road, and he just sci-fogs, as my dad would say, he sci-fogs all the way up the hill, and he gets to turning, you know, just 90 degrees to the west with this truck, and as I described, this thing is solid steel. So when you try to turn a solid steel object, about 4 tons, 90 degrees very rapidly, there's this pesky little thing that folks call, what is it, inertia? And so he gets up to the top of this hill, whips it 90. We're in one of these 5-foot ditches, and the truck is basically sitting on its side. And yeah, so he starts to have a meltdown. And his solution to this problem is, hey, Jared, I want you to walk all the way down this hill, which was not half a mile. This is like a mile and a half at this point. I want you to walk all the way down a mile and a half in the dark, no electric lights, to the house to get dad to come and get the truck out. I was like, okay. So I learned two things from my brother's mistake. One, how not to be afraid of the dark. So you just keep on going and you don't look for anything in the dark because you're going to psych yourself out. You just, it's like, we're fine. So how not to be afraid of the dark. And two, no matter how small, don't abuse the trust that your father gives you. He's like, take it to the church, take it right back, don't deviate. Well, we deviated in just a half mile. So you can learn from people, even in their foolishness. So I can also verify the mindset of trying to learn from people and everybody having something to offer, because my greatest revelations about God, and indeed my greatest proof for God's existence, came from atheists that I did not write off. They would say something or present a point of view that in my upbringing I did not have, and a still small voice would tell me to listen, and I would follow it through, and I would actually find out one of God's methodologies from their mindset because it was outside of my upbringing. But I won't get into that today. I could expound upon that and really nerd out, but I'll spare you that. So if humility is the key to shalom. That means we have a problem with pride. The opposite of humility is pride. No surprise there. So you've heard the phrase that history repeats itself. Can you guess why? Pride. You didn't learn, if I hadn't learned from my brother trying to, turn 90 degrees in a steel object without inertia, I probably would have tried to do the same thing, but, now I know how to turn a very heavy truck. Also, consequence of my brother's actions, my first car was not a cool Chevrolet classic truck. My first car was a baby blue 1991 Camry station wagon with a hole in the muffler. So when you hit the gas pedal, it would make, and I quote, I worked on this a long time. I had a friend that lived at Lake Ludwig. He knew when I was going home because of the sound of my accelerator with that hole in my. But had I not learned from that mistake, I would have repeated it. Entire generations of humans will repeat the mistakes of previous generations because we viewed our previous generations as inferior and chose not to believe ourselves capable of the same foolishness. If you read a brief history of war, you would see the same mistakes repeat over and over again. But mistakes repeat because we all have the same flawed heart. We all have that pride in our heart. And that flawed heart has a mindset of scarcity and distrust. Take from me, because if I share it with someone else, I might not have enough. We wrote off our elders, and we didn't choose to learn from them. A little humility could have greatly improved our history. So just to play off of this, I'm going to go straight into 2 Chronicles 7:14. Survey says, hey, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. So this passage, because context matters, I want to share with you where this actually came from. In this passage, this is God speaking to David's son, Solomon. He's speaking to Solomon, and in this chapter, he's outlining the terms of the Davidic covenant. If you were here a few weeks ago, you would have heard all about the Davidic covenant. Well, that covenant didn't go away when David was succeeded. God is actually describing this to Solomon, and this snippet of the Davidic covenant is, of the utmost importance because it goes past the legal. And it shows God's heart. God is actually stepping away from the do's and don'ts and getting into the why with this verse. Is it still there? Cool. If the people humble themselves and seek his ways, the results would be good. The act of their obedience would heal their land. Because, in a single word, God's way is humility. When it says to seek his face, it's a contrast with wicked ways. Seeking my face is seeking God's way. What is God's way? Humble. A lot of times we read the Bible and we think it's, lining stuff up in complex subjects. No, it tries to spell it out for you. Humble yourselves because that is God's way and not the wicked way. So what God's trying to say in this passage is the very act of humbling yourself will reconcile you to the people around you, and the wounds in the land will heal because of God's ways. This is not God saying, hey, if you do this, I'm going to reward you. That's a legalistic mindset. We got to get away from that. This is God saying, if you follow my ways, the healing will happen by itself. The healing is the humility. So how do we begin to heal our land that is full of pain, hurt, suffering, and still pride? Humble ourselves, pray, seek God's way of humility, and then the act of following God will bring restoration, reconciliation, unity, and wholeness. Shalom. So, why is the church in America not more influential then? I mean, for around 1,800 years, we have had this more or less formal thing called the church. It is switched and changed off because everybody has their opinion about how things should be done. The original church was very ragtag, very thrown together. Most everybody didn't even speak the same language. Their money management was a mess, but there was not a need among them because they were humble. So after near 2,000 years of doing this church thing, of claiming that we are the action of Christ in the world, why aren't we more influential? Why do people not want to listen to us? Why do people see Christians as judgy? Thank you. Before I could even switch gears in my mind, you're already hitting me. I like you. You get to sit in the front row. Pride. We let pride into the church. We started competing. So has each congregation, I'm borrowing the word congregation from C.S. Lewis because I think it's more unifying. C.S. Lewis, when he refers to the church, he means the whole church on earth. And when he says congregation, he describes it as you're in the same building, but your congregation's in a different door. And it's like clubs. C.S. Lewis saw the church as a house. Like, think of a house in Harry Potter. That's actually a formal British education system because you have houses, but the houses are broke up into divisions that are halls, rooms. And the house has its own traditions, but each room also has its own traditions, and the rooms or the halls are more individualistic than the house. So you have the rules of the house, and then you have the rooms. And C.S. Lewis saw all of Christianity as the house. This is one school of thought. We're unified under our basic principles, but each congregation goes about it a different way. So I say congregation, a small division of the church. So has each congregation humbled ourselves to learn from the other congregations, or have we written off other parts of God's church because we think that we should nitpick over small details and we want to actually compete for how many people we can get to attend? We need fog machines. We need coffee shops. We need to stop singing these songs because somebody was complaining about them. We need to get rid of prayer group and take kids to paintball. I won't get off on that because, yeah. So has the church at large sought to be a part of the communities we're in? Or have we written off everything that is secular because people might not believe as we do or they don't talk like we talk? We've let pride creep in. We've let pride creep in so that we want to look better and have more people than the church next to us over there. And we've let pride creep in because we want to be holier and seen as just better and higher society than people who don't have God. That is the opposite of what Jesus taught. Jesus, everywhere he went, people were murmuring about the kind of people he was rubbing elbows with. We are full of pride. We think we know better than everyone else, never thinking of what the end result of our pride would be, and that is division. Or as we, the church, have liked to call them, denominations. It's not divisions, it's denominations. We're not divided, we're denominated. It sounds like a math subject. If you denominate the primary integral of the trigonometric function, we've separated the church from secular bodies. We've separated the church from itself. Not even wanting a dialogue or discussion, we're not unifying or completing anything. We're competing. We're not achieving shalom. So how does humility fix this? How can such a simple, broad subject fix this? How can it unify? Well, I'm going to hit some rapid-fire scripture. Luke 18:9-14. Sorry, I keep on getting to the Family Feud references. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. I love that bit at the front that totally qualifies It's like, he didn't say Pharisees. He said, to some, kick the dirt, make eye contact, confident of their own righteousness and look down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, and even this tax collector. I love how tax collector was the worst of that group. I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all I get. But this tax collector stood at a distance, and he did not even look up to heaven. He was afraid to even look at God, and he wouldn't even approach the temple. He was so humble of himself. But he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Like, just quick, I want just look at the contrast between the Pharisee and the tax collector. The Pharisee goes into a great description of himself, but the tax collector, not only does he not give a great description of himself, he shortens it, a sinner. So not even trying to make a spectacle of it, just calling it like it is. So the tax collector was justified. He achieved shalom with God due to his humility and God's humility. God met him where he was at. He was standing away from the temple. His head was down. He wasn't looking up. He did not approach, but God came out to meet him. The person who actually was qualified to call themselves better humbled themselves and brought reconciliation. The Pharisee was not humbled, and he wasn't at shalom with anyone. He separated himself from the tax collector, and because he was not following God's way of humility, he separated himself from God while standing in God's face at the temple. Hitting up James 4:10 and 1 Peter 5:6, respectively, they both say essentially the same thing. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will lift you up. In 1 Peter 5:6, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. So, humble yourselves, lift you up. So in the passage from Luke, it said, those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who are humbled will be exalted. And then the other two passages, humble yourself and you will be lifted up. Humble yourself, and you'll be lifted up. Just so you know, in Hebrew literature, if it repeats itself, it really wants you to pay attention. I've spoken of that before. It's called Hebrew couplet verse. Repetition is just, it's like a bullhorn trying to get your attention. So what does it mean that if you're humble, you'll be exalted? Isn't that counterintuitive? Like, if you try to be humble and lower yourself, and you don't think of yourself above others, then others are going to grab you and say you're better than them? Is that what we're talking about? So, and this is something Matt came up with. I will not take credit for it. What it means when it says that you will be exalted, when you will be lifted up, if you're humble, it means you're going to get a seat at the table. It's not so much exalted as you are let in. I mean, so what table? Whose table? Any table you want. When you obey God and humble yourself, people will naturally want to keep you around because you exalt everyone apart from your own person fairly and equally. When you are welcoming, when you are humble, when you are welcoming, you are therefore welcomed, and at the right time, he will exalt your position among men around you such that you can share with them that which God has shared with you. You can share with them that the utopia God seeks to create by Jesus' sacrifice becoming the vehicle for instilling self-giving love into the hearts and minds of humanity. Put more directly, when you live with humility in your heart, people will like you, and pride makes people despise you. Humility is what builds. So just getting back to good old shalom. What does shalom have to do with humility? Shalom means being whole or complete, without holes in your heart. Going back to the analogy from last week, it's like a brick wall with no missing bricks. So what would the world be like if everyone understood that we can learn from each other, where we didn't write each other off? How could it change the dynamic of our world if we would listen? How could it change our relationships? Humility is like, going back to the brick wall, humility is like the mortar that glues the bricks together. It's easy to achieve wholeness between people when each of us is more interested in the benefit of others than the benefit of ourselves. With humility, we get out of our own way, on the way to true unified peace. So I just want to take a moment and invite everyone to just kind of look around at everybody, yeah, stare, hold the gaze awkwardly long, judge their haircut, look them up and down, and go. That's a technique called the sarcastic sniff. Somebody says something you don't believe, you go, uh-huh. And if they say nothing, it's the judgmental sniff. So just take a moment, look around at everybody in the congregation. I want you to realize what I just said, if, you know, as long as everybody was listening, what I just said, everyone heard this. Everyone heard this whole spiel about not writing people off. Everyone heard it. So don't be afraid that everybody in this room or anybody in this room is going to write you off. I mean, the cat's out of the bag, Mr. Turner. We know writing people off is not our God's way. So anybody in this room, I mean, we are approachable. I mean, if you don't think we've humiliated ourselves accidentally, we have, usually before practice on Sundays. No one's going to write you off. And we don't need to write other churches off when they approach us. Victory Ministries. I mean, we partnered with several churches because there's, not just in our congregation, but other congregations, I actually at work have spoken to other people about their churches in other towns, other parts of the state, far away, and the same thing's kind of happening everywhere. The churches are starting to stop. They're stopping writing each other off. And they're listening, and they're partnering, and you're like, okay, let's help people. Let's get food over here, transportation over here, warmth over here, wheelchair ramp over here. That's happening everywhere. It's not just us. We are part of something just kind of flying across the country like a wildfire. And I just want to end this on framing how Paul described Jesus' glory. I'll go ahead and invite the band to come back up. So Paul described the crucifixion of Jesus as Jesus' enthronement, his glory. And that seems kind of backward, because when kings are enthroned, there's a fanfare. They're celebrated, they're all dressed up and looking pretty. But Jesus was humiliated and tortured. Why was this an enthronement? Because it's the upside-down version of what the world values. The world wanted a king to be better than everyone else, to exalt themselves higher than everyone else, so that they could look at him and say, I want to be like that. But instead, they got a king who humbled himself and refused to retaliate against what was being done to him, even though he didn't have to take it. Humility, meeting people where they're at. The cross is the ultimate archetype of how God